to say, look, the state government, if not the federal government, needs to pay for these healthcare services, not private donors.
Amy, I want to get your comment on a speech that was made in the House. I wanted to turn to Democratic Congressmember Lucy McBath of Georgia, who's actually running in next week's Georgia primary. During a meeting of the House Judiciary Committee Wednesday, she shared her personal story about accessing reproductive care.
Like so many women in America, for years, I struggled to get pregnant. My husband and I, we tried everything that we could do to start a family of our own, and finally, we were successful. I had never been so happy, and I prayed for this moment for so many years. I wanted to tell everyone, I just wanted to shout it from all of the mountaintops. For weeks, I began to dream about our life and our future together. And then one day, I woke up covered in blood. And it's hard to describe the agony of a miscarriage. It's heartbreak, it's helplessness, it's pain, and it's profound sadness. Millions of women suffer from them, and I've heard from many who felt guilty like I did, who felt as though that we weren't worthy of having a child. Those are the same feelings that crept through my mind. And every time I've had these difficult discussions with other women, I remind them that they are strong and that they are powerful beyond measure, and that their worth is far more than their ability to procreate. However, it seems those in support of this ruling disagree. After my second miscarriage, I wondered in my grief again if God had decided I was never meant to be a mother. So when I finally got pregnant again, I was overjoyed. It was as if I believed that God was giving me and my husband, finally, he had a plan for us to be parents. But after 4 months, while feeling terror and trauma in my heart, I was rushed to the emergency room. There with my doctor and my husband, I learned that I had suffered a fetal demise or a stillbirth. There again, I was filled with anguish and sorrow and guilt, and I tried so hard, and still I felt like I failed trying to be a mother. My doctor thought it would be better to and safer to end the pregnancy naturally without the medicines so commonly used. So for 2 weeks, I carried my dead fetus and waited for me to go into labor. For 2 weeks, people passed me on the street, telling me how beautiful I looked, asking how far along I was, and saying that they were so excited for me and my future with my child. For 2 weeks, I carried a lost pregnancy and the torment that comes with it. I never went into labor on my own. When my doctor finally induced me, I faced the pain of labor without hope for a living child. This is my story. It's uniquely my story. And yet, it's not so unique. Millions of women in America, women in this room, women at your homes, and women you love and cherish have suffered a miscarriage. And so I ask, on behalf of these women, after which failed pregnancy should I have been imprisoned?
You are listening. Would it have been after the first?
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Portland students strike for the climate. The CDC recommends masks in six Oregon counties. And in international news, South Korea and the U.S. will start talks about addressing North Korean aggression. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, May 20th, 2022. I'm Jar Salem. Portland student activists walked out of school today, demanding the city leaders take meaningful action on climate change. Portland high school students rallied at City Hall and then marched to Revolution Hall, planning a climate festival anticipated to last through the evening. Thousands of children, students, and citizens from around Portland previously rallied in 2019, fighting for climate change. One of the organizers today is Ada Crandall, a sophomore at Grant High School. Crandall said the walkout was aimed at directly exposing so-called climate villains contributing to climate change. Crandall said, quote, "The climate villains are here in our own city, and they're not really all that far away from us, and they're hiding, and they need to be exposed. That is a lot of what the strike is trying to do," end quote. Crandall wanted organizers to be more strategic and intentional in their protests, especially because it's election season. Youth activists said one of their biggest demands is for the city to stop the expansion of new gas infrastructure from companies such as Northwest Natural. Students are pushing state and city leaders to come up with a plan to convert all buildings to be gas-free by 2040, prioritizing disproportionately impacted communities. A Northwest Natural public information officer said the company shares the students' concerns about the climate crisis, but did not comment directly on the demands. Students said they also want the city to shut down the Zenith Energy Oil Terminal. Other targets include the Portland Business Alliance and the Oregon Department of Transportation. The strike was aimed not only for students, but for people of all ages. Mayor Ted Wheeler, city and county commissioners, state representatives, Metro Council, and candidates for governor have been invited to sign a pledge promoting climate action. Organizers also reached out to Tina Kotek, who was nominated on Tuesday as the Democratic candidate for governor, but they said they have not yet received a response. Organizers also said their goal for this summer is to call attention to the climate injustices happening in Portland and to make it clear that it's not just fossil fuel companies causing the damage. Residents in six Oregon counties are now recommended to wear a mask indoors if they're at risk of getting COVID. This comes from federal and state health officials as cases climb in Oregon. Six counties are classified as medium risk. These are Multnomah, Clackamas, and Washington counties, plus Deschutes, Benton, and Columbia. State health officials point to a subvariant of Omicron, BA2, or stealth Omicron, as the culprit for the spike in cases. Last week, Multnomah County recommended that all residents wear masks indoors. Even with these recommendations and classifications from the CDC and the OHA, officials say there are no plans to reinstate a statewide mask mandate. Instead, they encouraged immunocompromised people to be extra cautious in a press conference Wednesday. State epidemiologist Dr. Dean Seilinger says immunocompromised folks should make plans with their doctors now for how to get tested and access treatment if they become ill. Native American carvers near Bellingham, Washington, have sent a totem pole on a journey around the Northwest as part of a campaign to remove four dams on the Snake River in southeast Washington. The dams have been blamed for impeding salmon, a source of food for orcas off the Washington coast. Eric Tegetoff has more on the story.
A totem pole from Washington State promoting a free-flowing Snake River has nearly completed its 2,500-mile journey around the Northwest. The Spirit of the Waters totem pole journey began at the beginning of May in Bellingham, near the Lummi Indian Reservation where it was carved. Since then, it's traveled through Oregon, Idaho, and back to Seattle on Thursday. Jewel James with the Lummi Nation's House of Tears Carvers is its head carver. He said the pole is 16 feet long, weighs 3,000 pounds, and sits on two carved 8-foot-long salmon.
The killer whale that has a baby whale on its nose to reflect Tahlequah, the whale that lost her calf and carried it around Puget Sound for 17 days and over 1,000 miles, trying to get the message to us, the human beings, that we are killing them off.
James says the journey is supporting the Shoshone-Bannock tribe's call to remove four dams on the lower Snake River in southeast Washington, which are impeding salmon migration. The salmon's population drop in the Columbia River Basin in recent decades also has starved southern resident orcas in Puget Sound. Dam supporters say they are integral for barging and irrigation in the region. But James says there's growing disappointment among tribes and conservation groups with lawmakers in action as salmon near extinction.
They're more pronged to protect the interests of corporations than they are the general public. And we find that a little frustrating.
The journey has brought together tribal members, conservation groups, and the faith community to call for the restoration of the Snake River. The totem pole is making its final stop in Tacoma today. For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Pennsylvania's Republican U.S. Senate primary is still too close to call. A $40 billion Ukraine aid bill is headed to President Biden's desk, and Oklahoma passes the strictest abortion bill in the country. With more on these stories, it's Mary Sherman with 2022 Talks.
Welcome to 2022 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
Every voter needs to have their ballot counted and their voice heard.
Pennsylvania's acting Secretary of the Commonwealth, Lee Chapman, said there are still about 50,000 primary ballots left to be counted from Tuesday's election, where Republican U.S. Senate candidates Dr. Mehmet Oz and former hedge fund CEO David McCormick remain neck and neck. Incumbents have not fared well in the 9 states holding primaries so far. 44 state legislative incumbents lost to challengers a rate of 4.7% compared to 3.3% in 2020. President Joe Biden is expected to sign the nearly $40 billion package of aid for Ukraine approved by the Senate, with Kentucky Republican Rand Paul among the 11 who voted against.
I wonder if Americans across our country would agree if they had been shown the costs, if they had been asked to pay for it.
Meanwhile, the Senate failed to overcome a key procedural hurdle to advance a $48 billion bid to provide pandemic aid to a number of industries, including restaurants. The House approved a bill to punish gas companies engaging in price gouging. However, Republican Fred Keller of Pennsylvania argues greater investments in American energy are needed to lower prices.
The Biden administration is intentionally suffocating domestic oil and gas production in hopes to replace fossil fuels with the socialist Green New Deal agenda.
Energy Secretary Jennifer Granholm expects record high gas prices to get worse before they get better, but is confident clean energy tax credits will be approved in bipartisan congressional energy and climate policy negotiations.
They absolutely need to pass, and I am feeling actually pretty bullish about it at this very moment.
Some congressional Democrats want the Biden administration to assign a national strategy coordinator to address the infant formula shortage. Senator Patty Murray says the blame lies with the company that recalled the formula, the FDA, and the government for a lack of interagency communication.
Nobody did their job here.
The White House announced the first flights to deliver infant formula from Europe to the U.S. will happen soon. The House committee investigating the January 6 attack wants to talk to Georgia Congressman Barry Loudermilk about a tour he gave the day before protesters stormed the U.S. Capitol. The committee is looking into reported attempts to obtain information about the layout of the building. Oklahoma passed a bill to ban abortions from the moment of fertilization and allow private citizens to sue abortion providers who perform the procedure. Vice President Kamala Harris condemned the legislation, among the strictest abortion bans in the country.
At its core, this is about our future as a nation, about whether we live in a country where the government can interfere in personal decisions.
The Department of Homeland Security is pausing its disinformation governance board just 3 weeks after its launch, pending a review of the larger strategy behind it. Critics objected to a lack of clarity over its mission and worried it would be used to censor free speech. For Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Mary Sherman. Find our A-Trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
A new report from the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities is urging states to prepare for the end of the public health emergency when they have to review Medicaid eligibility. COVID relief legislation in 2020 implemented continuous coverage through the public health emergency, but afterwards Medicaid agencies will have to go back to conducting reviews. Lily Bolke has more.
A new report urges states to take steps to minimize Medicaid coverage loss when the state of emergency for the pandemic comes to an end. COVID relief legislation in 2020 implemented continuous coverage for Medicaid through the public health emergency, meaning people can't be kicked off. It's set to expire in July, but the Biden administration has said it will give 60 days notice, so it's likely to be renewed until at least October. Farah Erzouki with the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities co-authored the report, and she notes many people's contact information has changed during the pandemic, and it's important for agencies to get ahead of that.
Millions of people have faced housing instability. Many people have moved. In addition to that, many and probably most people haven't been in touch with their agency since the start of the pandemic because they haven't needed to take any action to keep their coverage from getting terminated.
The report includes a variety of recommendations, including sending updates on the renewal process by text or email, as well as by mail. Report co-author Jennifer Wagner also is with the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities. She echoes that there are many opportunities for people to lose coverage despite remaining ineligible. She adds the increased workload might cause agencies to fall behind in answering calls and processing paperwork.
And these administrative burdens that are part of a poorly executed renewal process fall disproportionately on people of color who are more likely to rely on Medicaid due to historic discrimination and overrepresentation in low-wage work.
The report says for people who do become ineligible for Medicaid because of increased income, it's important for agencies to help them access marketplace coverage. It also recommends conducting outreach and obtaining updated contact information by partnering with other agencies, the U.S. Postal Service, and community-based organizations, as well as making sure all materials and messages are easy to understand and available in multiple languages. This is Lily Wolke with New Hampshire News Connection.
President Joe Biden's approval rating drops to the lowest point of his presidency in May, according to new numbers. A poll was conducted by the Associated Press NORC Center for Public Research. It showed 39% of U.S. adults approve of Biden's performance as president, falling from already negative ratings a month earlier. In addition, about 2 in 10 adults say the U.S. is headed in the right direction or the economy is good, both down from about 3 in 10 a month earlier. Even members of his own party were not particularly positive. 1/3 of Democrats say the country is headed in the right direction, down from about half in April. 73% approve of Biden's performance, a substantial drop since earlier in his presidency. In 2021, Biden's approval rating among Democrats never dropped below 82%. Many factors might be contributing to these results, including rising inflation, an explosion of gun violence, a sudden shortage of baby formula, and the societal effects of a persistent pandemic. Americans have also not seen effective plans for fighting climate change or fixing health care, despite campaign promises to address those issues. Overall, 2/3 of Americans disapprove of Biden's handling of the economy. That rating is mostly unchanged over the last few months, though it has elevated slightly since the first 2 months of 2022. Less than 1 in 10 Republicans approve of the president or his handling of the economy, but that does not represent a significant change. Immigration policy seems to be another problem area for the president. Only 38% back Biden on immigration, with many wanting the United States to more stringently control its southern border. Overall, 45% of Americans approve of Biden's handling of the U.S. relationship with Russia, which has held steady each month since the war in Ukraine began. 73% of Democrats and 15% of Republicans approve. The new poll shows just 21% of Americans say they have a great deal of confidence in Biden's ability to handle the situation in Ukraine. 39% have some confidence, and 39% have very little. The poll of 1,172 adults was conducted from May 12th through 16th, using a sample drawn from the probability-based AmeriSpeak panel, which is designed to be representative of the U.S. population. The margin of sampling error for all respondents is plus or minus 4 percentage points. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin, your look behind the headlines with fairness and accuracy in reporting. At 6, it's Rising Up with Sona Lee. Then at 7, Civic Cipher. Tonight's weather will be clear with a low of 40 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will be partly sunny with a high of 71. Today in history, in 1932, Amelia Earhart takes off from Newfoundland to begin the world's first solo nonstop flight by a female pilot across the Atlantic Ocean. She landed in Ireland the next day. The quote of the day is from American singer and actress Cher, who was born today in 1946. Cher said, "If grass could grow through cement, love can find you at every time in your life."
U.S. and South Korean leaders are meeting Saturday, and North Korea's nuclear weapons and missile program will be a major focus of those talks. Recently, there have been intelligence predictions of an imminent major weapons demonstration by the North. Presidents Joe Biden and newly inaugurated Yoon Suk-yeol will be discussing a nuclear threat of concern to both countries. Yoon is a conservative former prosecutor who took office on May 10th. He said he wants to strengthen ties with Washington while enhancing South Korea's missile strike and defense capabilities. He has also called for the resumption of large-scale U.S.-South Korean military exercises which were downsized or suspended during the pandemic and ineffective nuclear talks between former President Donald Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. Some predict Biden will bring up a desire for a broader role from South Korea in the alliance, moving away from a focus mostly on North Korea, especially as U.S. foreign policy attention shifts towards confrontations with China and Russia. Yoon is expected to declare South Korea's participation in the Indo-Pacific Economic Framework, a new U.S.-led regional partnership aimed at promoting cooperation in trade, supply chain resiliency, technology, and other issues. That step almost certainly will anger China, South Korea's largest trading partner. According to Seoul's Asian Institute for Policy Studies, Korea's leading independent policy think tank, Yoon will also seek a statement from Biden reaffirming a U.S. commitment to provide extended deterrence to South Korea, plus a vow to defend its ally with its full range of military capabilities, including nuclear weapons, in the event of war with North Korea. The Biden administration, meanwhile, has shown no willingness to remove crippling economic sanctions against North Korea unless it accepts meaningful cutbacks to the North Korean nuclear arsenal. The United States wants strengthened security cooperation with South Korea and Japan and a stronger role for Seoul in the region. North Korea has tested missiles 16 separate times this year. In March, we saw its first flight of an intercontinental ballistic missile since 2017, which demonstrated a potential range including the entire U.S. mainland. It has also been expanding its arsenal of short-range solid-fuel missiles targeting South Korea. Some South Korean conservatives have called for the government to ask the United States to bring nuclear weapons back to South Korea after removing them in the 1990s. Minnesota's current balance of power in state government might prevent a wave of voter restriction laws from being enacted. But a new report highlights concerns about such laws even being proposed as states see a push for what pro-democracy groups describe as election subversion. There's also concern about candidates pushing election fraud narratives. Mike Moen has the story.
Examples of proposed policies and candidates tied to false claims of election fraud have spread to Minnesota, and a new national report says the movement isn't slowing down ahead of this fall's vote. A trio of voter rights groups issued findings into how state legislatures are trying to subvert elections, including more leeway to reject results, requiring partisan or outside audits, and shifting power away from election administrators. Some of these ideas have been floated by Minnesota Republicans but are not likely to pass under the current balance of power. Still, Rachel Homer of Protect Democracy says simply proposing them poses a threat.
This is about everyone in support of democracy in both political parties really need to be standing against this movement towards autocracy.
Despite calls for unity, Republicans are seeing more candidates for statewide offices who either perpetuate the stolen election narrative or suggest current laws need restrictions they say would tighten election security. The Minnesota GOP recently endorsed such a candidate running for Secretary of State, an office that oversees elections. The report says 175 such laws were introduced in the U.S. this year. Homer says false election fraud claims that took shape following Donald Trump's loss in the 2020 presidential vote have ballooned to a five-alarm fire. She notes even if most bills don't pass, voters are still being exposed to theories soundly rejected by the courts.
These bills are being proposed by a lot of legislators across a lot of states, and so they clearly think there's an audience for it.
Those behind the report say it's important to remember most administrators, staffs, and volunteers are committed to free and fair elections. Outside of the findings, Sylvia Albert with the group Common Cause says potentially having some of these candidates take office is concerning. If election results were to be rejected without a valid reason, she says it might be harder to seek recourse.
So there definitely is an ability to challenge in court
the courts are leaning more and more towards stepping away and letting the political process run itself. And what that does is not protect the people who don't have power, which are just normal Americans.
Mike Moen, Minnesota News Connection. Find our rate trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org. Support for this reporting was provided by the Carnegie Corporation of New York.
The Confederated Salish and Kootenai tribes will be celebrating the return of the bison range that was illegally taken by the U.S. government over 100 years ago. With that story and more, it's Megan Kamrick with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Megan Kamrick in for Antonio Gonzalez. The first Native American U.S. Interior Secretary, Deb Haaland, will be in western Montana Saturday to help celebrate the return of the bison range to the Confederated Salish and Kootenai tribes. MTPR's Aaron Bolton has more.
The tribes earlier this year officially took over management of the bison range, which was illegally taken by the U.S. federal government in the early 1900s. Haaland is scheduled to speak at the Salish Kootenai College Saturday afternoon. Assistant Secretary for Indian Affairs Brian Newland, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Services Director Martha Williams, and Montana Lieutenant Governor Kirsten Juris will be on hand as well to celebrate the return of the land with CSKT leaders. CSKT spokesperson Shane Morgeau.
For us at CSKT, this is a step forward in the right direction. It was really right and wrong in our history, and we're happy to be reunited with our bison herd and the lands out there and the resources.
The celebration will take place on Saturday. A community lunch and powwow will be held at the bison range on Friday as well. For National Native News, I'm Aaron Bolton.
Members of the Narragansett Indian tribe will have free access to the beach in Massachusetts that bears the tribe's name. The Providence Journal reports the Narragansett Town Council narrowly approved the measure after a contentious four-hour public meeting this week. The popular beach typically requires a $12 access fee plus parking. The measure was unpopular with many of the town's residents who say the beach is already overcrowded. Resident Joe Cardello reflected many people's opinion that the action is poorly thought out.
To give a blanket $3,000, I don't care who it is. I don't care if it's the Indians or anybody else. But I will tell you this. If you're going to give anybody a free pass, it should be the taxpayers of this town. Because we pay the taxes.
Narragansett tribal member Bella Noka reminded those at the meeting that the word Narragansett is not a town or a beach, but the name of a thriving nation. She says access is not about recreation or sunbathing.
That is where we go to Grandfather Ocean in ceremony. Your homes, your big, beautiful homes, you dug up our ancient burial grounds to build them.
The original idea came up during a roundtable meeting in February with tribal members and others. A trial is underway in Alberta where two white men are charged with the murder of two Métis hunters 2 years ago. Roger Bilodeau and his son Anthony Bilodeau shot and killed Jacob Sansom and his uncle Maurice Cardinal after an encounter along a country road. The Bilodeaus forced the confrontation because they suspected the two Indigenous men were thieves. The two men did not call authorities following the shooting. Attorneys say the defendants opened fire in self-defense. In California, the state Senate confirmed the first Native American to hold a district judgeship. Courthouse News reports Sunshine Suzanne Sykes was confirmed by a vote of 51-45. She would also be the first Article III judge in the country who is a member of the Navajo Nation. Article III judges have lifetime appointments on federal, district, and circuit courts, as well as the Supreme Court. Sykes was previously a judge on the Superior Court of Riverside County in California. And the University of California Berkeley School of Law announced it will cover all tuition for current and future students who are both California residents and members of federally recognized tribes. Reuters reports administrators say they want to make Berkeley Law a destination for Native American students. They hope to expand the program to students from federally recognized tribes who are not California residents. Native Americans made up just 1% of first-year law students around the country this academic year. For National Native News, I'm Megan Kamrick.
Public health experts promote the benefits of electric vehicles in underserved communities. These cars don't emit harmful tailpipe pollution. Dr. Anthony Leisowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Leisowitz, and this is Climate Connections.
When Dr. Shelley Francis bought her first electric vehicle, she was thrilled that she would no longer need to buy gas. And as a public health professional, she says she was excited to drive a car that does not emit harmful tailpipe pollution.
Once I purchased my gently used, which was new to me, electric vehicle, I wanted to tell everyone in my community about how much money this was saving me, as well as talking with them about the impact that it would have on community health.
She realized people need to talk about these benefits more, especially in communities that are plagued by air pollution.
For far too long, communities of color, as well as other frontline communities, rural communities, have been left out of discussions about transportation electrification solutions, even though it's these very communities whose health and well-being are being most impacted by fossil fuel burning vehicles like trucks and buses, etc.
So to help change that, Frances and her friend Terry Travis started a nonprofit called EV Hybrid Noir. The organization brings together a diverse group of EV drivers from across the country who want to share their passion for EVs with others, and it conducts outreach and advocacy to accelerate the adoption of EVs in a more equitable and inclusive way. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Friday, May 20th, 2022. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes myself, Josh Salem. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Megan Cameron, Mary Sherman, Lily Bolke, and Mike Moan. The director of the evening news is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm.